the chain of reasoning or events that can lead to people doing or believing or saying something is so unbelievably complex that, you know, we can't even explain it ourselves. And so rather than making assumptions about who people are and what they stand for and what they care about, things that all have a tendency to change, it's better just to try to develop relationships.
Of the Sharpener Report. I'm your host, Sam Johnson. You can find me on YouTube, iTunes, Blog Talk, and you can find me at Twitter at Sam T. Johnson. It is a special Wednesday edition of the Sharpener Report because I'm out of town this weekend and because we're going to talk about the election, which just happened last night. And if I waited 2 days to talk about it, the stuff we talked about now would maybe be not as important because of the way the news cycle moves so quickly. And joining us today is the host of On the Objective, Stephen Menking. Stephen has a background in economics and always has his ear to the political world, so I thought I'd bring him on. We'd have a nice conversation about maybe about what does this election mean, what were the results, and what can we do going forward to help progressing in the right direction. So, without further ado, Mr. Menking, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine here, Sam. You have a lot of mixed emotions, and depending on how closely people follow the political spectrum, a lot of heated reactions on both sides to items small and large. I think that what often will happen in these sorts of things is that everything gets dialed down into the nitty-gritty and the minutiae of second-to-second real-time poll analysis and results and everything, that often we can get an experience of whiplash in terms of expectations, because the way that we think about these things is there's a hinge moment, whether it's an election, that's typically the most broad thing, but it can be anything else. For a student, maybe they're applying to college, or for someone, you're waiting to hear whether you got a job. So, you know, you can imagine if you were waiting to hear whether you got the job and you were getting live updates from someone outside the boardroom who was like kind of listening in to the attitude. It's like, yes, no, maybe so. We get this back and forth that puts people into a state of heightened emotionalism, particularly when their expectations aren't met. And so we had a result where the Republicans held the Senate and are looking to expand that majority by several seats. There are still certain things that are up in the air, so that could change, but the majority is intact. The Democrats have obtained the majority in the House of Representatives. And so for people looking for an overwhelming super majority obtaining victory for a Trump coalition of Republicans, that didn't happen. And for people looking for the kind of wipeout blue wave election of the magnitude that we've seen in historical midterm races like 2010 and 1994, where we're talking about a 50-60 seat swing, this looks to be roughly half of that. The need was, I think, 25 or so, and the Democrats are likely to pick up low 30s in the House. So it's a majority. And so we now have a split Congress. The governor's races followed a similar kind of pattern. Looks like the Republicans will have the majority of the governorships, but there's a lot of wonkery to unpack because of all of the different implications, and we can go in any direction that you'd like, Sam. But from a big picture perspective, at a certain point, you know, you have to avoid the totally human tendency to get worked up with the information flow, particularly the back and forth of it. We have these elections that are coming down to the wire, so it's a yes, no, and then we would have a tendency to take that and then project it forward into the most advantageous and the most disadvantageous according to our perspective. So you're swinging back and forth, not between some minor incongruity here. You're swinging back and forth between the projected incongruity of, you know, a separation of two radically different states of the world. So we'll see. It's never a surprise when everyone's expectations are disappointed. Kind of the same thing with biblical prophecy, in that we're talking about matters that are so complex that we really can't do anything other than gauge things based on feeling and the best data that we can. So nobody was totally right. There are different things to point out in terms of the dynamics, but what has been is what will be, and we will see how all of this plays out most saliently over the course of the next 2 years in the run-up to the 2020 election cycle, which officially begins now. And so if you're not interested in politics, you can sort of just tune that stuff out for about 18 months, which would probably be good. But if you are, then you're never short on anything to dive into. So that's a really brief recap and a perspective on some of the emotional turmoil that I observed last night.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important to go over those, the overview for sure. You're definitely seeing things. A lot of this stuff isn't really super surprising. Going back to Obama's first midterm, you know, he lost way more. He lost, I think, 46 people out of the House and 6 out of the Senate, flipped the majority on both sides. And so you see things like this. I don't really want to dive too much into the numbers and that aspect, because you can look it up on your own and figure that stuff out. But one thing that I do want to talk about, you know, maybe is a little different than a lot of other midterm coverage, is the spiritual ramifications that come from an event like this. Because in my worldview, and I'm pretty sure in your worldview as well, we have two forces. We have good versus evil in all things. And a lot of people love to plant, if you're Republican, it's good, and Democrat is evil, and those are the two spiritual forces. But in reality, it's not that way at all. You know, good can use both the Democratic and Republican side, and evil can definitely use both the Democratic and Republican side. So one theme that we've consistently seen through at least this Trump presidency is the rise of division. You know, the both sides seem to be at each other's throat, trying to create this rift that's unbanded. You can't fix it. And you saw that a lot in the midterms last night, with a lot of the moderates on both sides losing out to more of the extreme on each side, either someone who's all on board with Trump or someone who's so anti-Trump they don't want anything to do with it. You lost a lot of that moderate on side. You saw a couple socialists. Cortez made it in, the young 29-year-old made it in. She's a straight-up socialist. So you're seeing a lot of this widening of the gap. So my guess is What have you observed from the spiritual warfare aspect of things that you saw in the midterm election? Is that a coherent question?
It is. It's a tricky one, and you've expressed many different ideas that I know a whole host of people would certainly disagree with. So my observation about the broadening or narrowing of the overarching political spectrum first, and then we'll talk about the spiritual warfare aspect of it. So what we saw was a scenario where we had an awful lot of incumbents stepping down and not running again for re-election. We're talking about really prominent people too. So this is a unique election in that regard, because there wasn't necessarily the same kind of incumbent preservation model. And a lot of these incumbents were not necessarily friendly to President Trump's agenda. And you would consider them of the more rhino Republican in name only kind of variety, where they'd be in favor of globalist policies and, essentially one member of the uniparty that has held sway for such a long time. And from a spiritual perspective, we do see this further splintering, but more into enclaves. I think that on one hand, you can say, all right, the outright socialist candidates in Texas and Florida and Georgia and different people that were attempting to run outside of deep blue liberal enclaves, they didn't make it despite a ton of effort and money and resources and celebrity endorsements and other kinds of factors that were thrown into those races. But you did see in the deep blue areas of the country, people get elected with these more further afield perspectives in the left direction. And so it's difficult to say exactly what all of this means from a spiritual warfare component, from a tactical perspective. But I'd just like to point out that no possible election result would change the overall strategy, would change the Great Commission that Christians are called into, would change the overriding importance of spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ and reaching out to those who are lost, of building up our gifts in the faith and following the calling that God has given each and every one of us. So our roles in that kind of perspective don't change. But from an observation standpoint, one of the things you can say is that there are political ramifications to the spiritual condition of a nation and the state of spiritual warfare. And that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a controversial position. The controversy would arise more when you talk about the who, what, where, why, when, and how aspects of these things in terms of what we should do, what we should be battling against, and the way that things go in general. One of the things that we tend to observe, and this is ironically almost an observation of the coastal liberal elites, is that people really aren't very well informed about things. And the decisions that were made in terms of the state level races versus the district level races, it's a tricky kind of dynamic. And so people are going to do a lot of work unpacking these sorts of things. And the demographic shift, and there's redistricting and gerrymandering concerns and the 2020 census and all of these different points of intrigue. But to circle all the way back around to the primary question here, what are the spiritual warfare ramifications? Well, it means that people who are Christians and awake to the understanding of evil have to continue to press in, and on top of that, and I think most importantly, have to understand that victory doesn't always look like the victory that you wanted to see. And that's a difficult thing to do, because from another perspective here, you could just as easily say, well, that's just ex post facto rationalization. That's just explaining away a loss by saying, yeah, there's like some mysterious victory here, or this is hunting for a silver lining. But in fact, our humility and our reliance and trust upon God should put us in a position where we have to say, look, Jesus's closest disciples didn't recognize what was going on, even though he told them directly, hey, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to die, and then I'm going to rise again. I'm going to, you know, overcome death. And they're like, no, like Peter even tried to rebuke him for that in a way by saying, no, I mean, I thought we were going to like overthrow the Roman Empire and take over the whole thing. Like all of the second coming prophecies are, you know, right there in the only book we have. And so what's up with all that kind of stuff? Now that we know that you are the Messiah, where are you going? What's up with this whole story? And so the full picture wasn't revealed and never will be. And so what you do see today is people having a different reframing of the landscape, and in many cases, even going back and saying, well, what was victory supposed to look like? What are the pros and cons of the circumstance that we're in? And, you know, on my end, I'm thankful that there aren't riots in the streets everywhere. You know, that's definitely a good thing. But you know, it feels like there's a longer game at work, and there's nothing I can do to sort of shrug that off. Now, my expectation was for the Republicans to do better in the House. That was sort of a default position based on the early voting and other numbers I was seeing. But this was a tremendously significant turnout for a midterm election. So more people are involved than tended to be historically. And so the question is, are more people on the Christian side going to be involved, not just politically, but spiritually? There's been a lot of not just voter apathy, but Christian apathy in terms of taking up the banner of the kingdom of God and going forth under his protection and walking in righteousness, which Lord knows we need to struggle for every day. There's a lot of anger and a lot of pain and a lot of emotion going on last night from both sides in many different directions for many different reasons. And so for us, it's one thing to just say, let's just give it to God. But we do have to do that. We have to do that thoughtfully and prayerfully as we look for our marching orders. The game is never over.
Yeah, I think that maybe you have a little more what's the word? I think you trust the process of the election and our government probably more than I do. You have a little more faith in it. To me, I look at the political landscape and I see the Democrat and the Republicans and the overall course of our country seemingly going one direction. And so when these elections happen, a part of me, you know, gets nervous about the potential of this is all just kind of a show. You know, this is all just up for just to make people think and push people a certain way. So when I see elections that the result is more division, if you ask me, that is the overall theme, is the result is more division. You know, the House is not going to be able to subpoena Trump more. They're going to be able to, you know, dive into all these certain investigations and really, you know, rally their base up and make the Republican base even more frustrated. And so I just, to me, that is what the outcome of that, that was the outcome. That's how Satan is going to use this election, is to greater, you know, lead people away from this unity and this community that we're trying to push because of just the fierceness that's going to come out on both sides. And you see that with the narratives coming up. That's one thing I love to do, is look at the narrative of each side, you know, and the Democrats is, oh, we took the House. It's one step further. Now we're going to be able to go after Trump. And then the Republicans is, you know, we gained more in the Senate, you know, and then they compare it to historical numbers like we kind of did in the beginning. And even Reagan's numbers, how they gained more people than Reagan did in his first midterm. And so it's kind of like it's one small step. And then, you know, for the Republicans, it's even more like, oh, now the Democrats are going to show their hand and it's going to be an easy win for Trump in 2020. And it just seems like we've got a greater division here than we ever have. And so it's hard for me to figure out where to put that into my mind and where to go from there.
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with that ardently healthy skepticism of these governmental processes. In fact, that should be the default position. The perspective that I'm trying to bring is not necessarily as a purposeful counterbalance just for the sake of it. But and we can go into this at whatever depth we'd like. One of the key things that, you know, regardless of the back and forth and regardless of the division, what everyone tends to then gravitate towards in terms of taking solace in the Senate is that not only is the majority there really properly secure because several people like Flake and McCain and, you know, people who had opposed President Trump's agenda, which made it like he was working 2 years with almost not a functioning majority, because he had the House and the House was pushing for many things, but was also, you know, led by Paul Ryan, who was no friend to the president for sure, and was among that significant cadre of dozens of people who stepped down and decided not to run again, including very prominent figures Daryl Issa and many others. So, you know, we're in a situation where the courts will be changed for years and decades because of not just the last 2 years, but these upcoming 2 years. There's no way to stop that if reasonable people are put forward into these judgeships. And I think that we would do ourselves a disservice if we would discount the extent to which the illusion of well, it's not totally an illusion because it's happening, but the causal drift away from God and towards, secular progressivism over the past 50 years has been directed by the courts at not just the Supreme Court level, but at the appellate level and federal circuit level in terms of, you know, taking prayer out of schools, and then it has to ratchet its way all the way up. And so if you actually are able to appoint judges, you know, it's almost 100 now at this point with a semi-adversarial majority of the most extreme narrow margins in the Senate. Now you have a more comfortable space in order to do that. And the message from the elections is that when Trump ardently campaigns for you and you back the president, then you win. And that's what happened in some key Senate demographics. And that when you participated in the Kavanaugh smearing and you voted against him, then you lost in the Senate. And of course, it's easier to identify the individual people in the Senate because there's fewer of them and they were the ones who were actually voting on it. Mm-hmm. So the House and the Senate have definitely distinct components, and the House turns over every 2 years. That's not to suggest that it's not important. You get some very interesting and revealing things there in terms of demographics and the split in the country that is certainly not healed, and many would argue as you have suggested that it can be widened. I think that there is a path to greater unity here, but again, it's all contingent upon the touch of God on this nation, and that is contingent upon us repenting and coming to grips with things and being humble and really pressing in to God and being equipped and able to handle the spiritual warfare that's necessary. I mean, we had a couple states with ballot initiatives, no taxpayer funding for abortion, extending rights to, you know, consider the preborn, and, you know, so at a state level and at a court level, it's not as if the news is absolutely catastrophic. I mean, you know, given where we are versus where in 2015 and 2016, many people, including myself, thought we might be. I mean, this is certainly a preferable scenario. It's not without its warts or problems, but that's because we're dealing with a monstrously ugly and evil system. And so we don't have the power to directly go up and do battle with powers and principalities. Like, that's not, you know, that's if the angels aren't going to, you know, it takes them some time to deal with this and get to Daniel through the Prince of Persia and everything else like that. You know, we have to be very careful with the way that we're conducting ourselves. And that starts with our own lives and our own responsibility towards ourselves and towards our families. And so, you know, a disappointment that many people feel, and, you know, rightly so. If your expectations are set at a level and then they're disappointed for whatever reason, then you feel disappointment. That's a pretty normal kind of mechanic. But what I'm saying is not that we should have we should be, let's say, defaulting to trusting the governmental process. Like, there's clearly extensive corruption that still needs to be ferreted out. But that when you contextualize different things, if we're not going to go, and we shouldn't, because it, like, just feels so pointless and oversaturated to get into all the specific kind of wonky details, then you have to zoom out far enough to say, hey, there are still people who are unsaved, and that was going to be the case regardless of the election outcome, and those people need Jesus, like, desperately need Jesus. And what we can see is that there is still an extensive level. I mean, yeah, you have to either, I don't think there's a way around this. It's either there is extensive corruption and voter fraud or extensive deception, and maybe it's both. And for us, you know, we can do some things about both of those, but the deception is spiritual in nature. And that is where, that's where our conduct and our warfare and our prayers can be focused. Because, you know, it's difficult. If you are paying attention to the mainstream news, and it seems like, tragically, plenty of people still are, and you've voted one way for your entire life, it's very difficult to change that behavior pattern. It takes a real transforming of your heart, a transforming of your mind, a transforming of your worldview. And that can only come to this fullest extent through a renewed or, you know, a born again relationship with Jesus Christ. And so that's the primary area, I think, Sam. It doesn't do me much use to fret about things, even though there's tons of things to fret about and to analyze and to pick apart, when I have to make sure that I'm not taking this and pulling back from my prayer closet, or pulling back from my Bible reading. And, you know, I'm speaking to myself here. I have to continuously redouble these efforts, because there's an inertia, like a worldly inertia, that if you don't actively seek to maintain these things, it'll pull you away. And whether it's the political process or career or relationship or wealth or entertainment or any of these other things, you know, we have to make God the priority, because if we don't make God the priority, then the math doesn't work. We're not going to see righteousness restored and justice achieved in our nation the way that we so desperately need it to be. And so I would say that the default position, the status quo now, is that we're going to get greater division and hectic activity and chaos and gridlock. I think that it's probably going to be milder than people assume, just because my general bent is that when people make forecasts and assumptions immediately following a period of high emotion, those forecasts tend to be exaggerated. But mm-hmm. of course, that doesn't mean that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. It just means that, you know, we have to be careful and considerate with these things, and then ask, where is our time best spent at the end of the day?
Yeah, definitely. And I think those two perspectives that you and I both laid out really encompass the pull on either side, with Satan's plan being division and being to drive people apart through the illusion of the completely wholesome government, as many people would view it. And then you also have the, you know, God's plan that's potentially, you know, working through the court system and revamping a lot of rulings that were anti-Christian, anti-God on what those beliefs are, and then also using the people locally to change their local communities and their local areas, you know, politically and spiritually. So I think those two are a really good breakdown of what could happen on the spiritual side for both sides. It's just so important for people to remember that Satan has his hand in the government, Republican and Democrat. Like, there are people in the deep state, there are people out there who do not have your best interests, who want power and want our country to go a direction, you know, even towards the communism and the socialist aspect, even though they claim to be Republican. So that's something that I hate when people get stuck to. It's the same thing when watching media. They say, oh, CNN sucks, but Fox News? Nah, Fox News is good. It's like, nah, they're both terrible. 90% of our media is owned by 6 different companies. So it's about breaking free from each narrative, because there's going to be narratives on both sides, and you don't want to fall into one on either side, because those narratives are put forth immediately by people in control, so you think a certain way. So it's so important to really analyze things differently and look at, where are the spiritual forces playing in this, and where do I actually want to line up? So I'm lining up with God and not lining up, you know, with Satan. And so I think that's a great comparison that you did with those two, for sure.
Well, I would supplement those excellent points by saying, look, it pays to have courage and to stand for your principles and not to back down. And if you give it your shot like that and you lose, you can lose with dignity, the way that John James did in Michigan. Now, you know, I was hoping that he would win that particular race, and by many metrics he should have. But look, the Republican Party has for a long period of time been feckless and afraid and compromised and corrupt, and we're seeing the vestiges of them not being able to match the Democrat and the Democrat tactics in terms of ground game and getting out the vote and name recognition and all of this. And so, you know, ultimately, I agree with your point that if we think in these sort of siloed terms, then we're going to get the division that the powers that be want, just because it's easier to execute a strategy of control from an unelected bureaucracy by providing the illusion of choice. Of course, this is the well-trodden Hegelian dialectic consideration and the ideas of the Overton window. We won't revisit that because your audience is hopefully well aware of those kind of dynamics. What I wrote down as you were talking is what I think is a really important question, and it's, is there a precedent for when God's plan actually involves or is division? And this is a little bit sneaky because you have to ask the question, well, at what level and what does that mean? What does that look like? So here's a couple different scriptural examples off the top of my head. You'll have to look these up for the exact citations. But when the northern kingdoms, so we're Old Testament here, when the northern kingdoms split from Judah, and this is from Solomon's son, if I'm remembering these things correctly, after he took the advice of his young advisors and said, you know, I'm going to chastise you with scorpions. That doesn't seem like a good idea in particular. But everyone was like, you know, we're out of here. We're going back to our tents, as people so often do. And then they were going to go fight. They were going to say, all right, you know, no, you're not leaving. We're staying united. We are going to fight you in battle. And the word came down through a prophet, I believe. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's like, no, don't go out to battle. This is from the Lord. And in this case, we're talking about a complex history of rebellion and essentially these prophecies of this separation, even through, you know, Solomon himself. And so the division of the kingdoms was, you could say, and this depends on other complex theological questions, so we're wading into heavy territory here. You could say is that part of God's plan? Like, was it, you know, it was something that God allowed to happen and indeed said was going to happen in response to disobedience. So was God's plan for there to be disobedience? Then, you know, you get into all sorts of different conversations about sovereignty there. But fast forwarding to the New Testament, you see other situations where we're not supposed to be equally yoked, where there are times when we have to break fellowship with people. And then we see in the Psalms where there is unity, God commands a blessing. And so I think the question is, where is this unity supposed to be? And where are there times when division is the only or even best path forward? And so that's a difficult question to answer because it seems circumstantial, because you can point to different things and proof text it this way or that. And unless your situation corresponds to the exact sort of case study from the Bible, it can be left up to interpretation to a certain extent. But what seems to me is that a primary problem is that the church is not unified. You have people making different decisions with their faith, with their beliefs, with their worldview, with their treatment of the Bible, and that translates to different decisions in the voting booth. And so on one hand, you have people who say, how could you espouse Christianity and support a party whose main plank, or at least one of their main planks, is murdering the unborn? And then on the other hand, you have people saying, how could you be a Christian and vote for a party whose main plank is a strong border policy that, you know, contradicts the very clear commandment to love your neighbor and even to love your enemies under any and all circumstances. And so what we have are these sort of catch-all approaches to these biblical doctrines that represent a state of disunity. And it's not a surprise to me because of this that we don't have unity in the nation, because we don't even agree on what's right and wrong inside of the church, let alone having a common morality between Christian and secular culture. It's a mixture, and it's a pernicious mixture when you look at it and see it through some particular lenses in terms of tracing back how these things arise and everything else. You know, I'm not going to go into the history lesson here, because it's beyond the scope, and there's too many rabbit trails there, as you well know. But the point is that if we're going to get unity, we have to understand where unity starts and what that should look like. And from my perspective, the true unity comes with a full communion and relationship with God. And it's only through God's Holy Spirit that we're going to get the kind of unification that is productive, as opposed to the kind of unification that it tilts into either cult-like activity or totalitarianism. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of uniformity in top-down soul-crushing order tyrannical structures, but we have to have unity in the freedom and in the peace and in the spiritual walk that only God Himself can provide. And so if Jesus isn't actively living in us and through us through the agency of the Holy Spirit, then we're not going to be unified. We're going to be parts of the body fighting against itself. Mm-hmm. It's literally cancerous.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just doesn't surprise me that we don't see unity on a national political level when there isn't even unity among the groups who call themselves Christians.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Jesus said he came to divide, not to unite. You know, and that's one big aspect of when we're trying to look at elections, when it's two forces against each other, what does that type of verse mean? And it definitely does not mean I'm a Republican, so I'm going to stay divided from people who are Democrat or vice versa, because that is that you are uniting under a worldly force. You know, whether you think Republicans are the greatest thing ever and conservatism is the weight of the future, it doesn't matter. That's still a worldly force. You have to be able to unify under scripture and be open to, you know, having discussions with people on the Democratic side who are Christian and who view the world differently. Now, I obviously view the world a certain way, and I'm not going to agree with everything or even a lot of things that the way Democrats view, especially when you get into the socialistic aspects that they think scripture promotes. It to me, that's completely the opposite. But I'm still willing to enter into a discussion with them and try to find out what the root morality is that we need to strive for, like you talked about, through our country. And so I feel like with elections, and I think this is part of the purpose, or at least what Satan uses elections for, is to root our loyalty in the wrong things. It's oh, I'm going to root it so strongly in Democrat, I'm going to root it so strongly in Republican that becomes my identity. And that's not what we want at all. You have to be able to break free from, again, the controlled mindset of what has been shoved down your throats for so long, is that you're either one or the other. It's part of the two-party system that has been in our lives the whole time. It's us versus them, no matter what the case is. And if you take some time and go over to the opposite ideology as what you believe in, whether if you're Democrat, then you go to Republican, or you go to Republican, you go to Democrat, and you actually look at the people on that side and what they're saying, most of it isn't just straight up evil things that they want to just do all these terrible things to you. A lot of it's just they have compassion on certain aspects of things, or they're passionate about something else that if you were to truly understand the type of person they were, you could unify yourself with them and have a discussion and work towards a common, you know, root morality that our country needs. So I think that's a great point, and that's a lesson that needs to come out of these elections. It is not at all about Republican versus Democrat. It's good versus evil. It's God versus Satan.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, Sam, and that's quite well put. And what I find is that and we've talked about this before, spiritual warfare doesn't always have to look like, you know, fiery battles in the heavens. Okay, it doesn't have to look like the earth opening up, although it certainly can. Oftentimes, spiritual warfare is done in the dismantling of a stronghold in unexpected ways. The key example that we have, of course, is the march around Jericho and then the blowing of a horn. So, you know, what might we be able to take away from that and these other examples? Well, what you're talking about in terms of reaching across the aisle to having a conversation is something that is not on the table for many people. And what I would say is that your default position is that it should be on the table, and that the way that you can navigate that appropriately is by conducting spiritual warfare by asking the right questions. Okay. So you'll notice that when Jesus is teaching, of course, the Sermon on the Mount and everything else, it's full of rhetorical questions. And when he's debating the scribes and the Pharisees and the people who are accusing him, he's asking them questions, and they don't have the answer to them. Now, of course, that doesn't stop them from coming against him in the strongest possible ways in terms of condemning him to death and, you know, seeking to destroy him by any means possible. But there's a difference between a railing accusation that we would bring against people who we think we disagree with, and a question that we can ask that will uncover different sorts of things. And ultimately, while I understand the different doctrines and share the perspectives that at root the heart is evil and we have to work actively to overcome this, I think that you'll find that when you talk to people, for the most part, unless they're hardened activists and communists or people who are essentially ideologues who have been brainwashed, unfortunately.
AKA most millennials.
Yeah, well, you know, preaching to the choir here. But even in that demographic, you can ask questions to try and tease things out. And the first thing that you'll find is that people haven't really given much thought to their belief system or their belief structure. And this is, of course, one of the common complaints that is levied against Christianity by atheists, in that because Christianity was the dominant structure, people just accepted it as the status quo or default belief system without questioning it. And now the same thing is happening in more secular areas where people like literally haven't thought about any of these things. It's just kind of what you do. And there's this inertia that leaves layers and layers of unexplained positions, unexplained actions, and unexplained results. And so if you plant a seed by asking the right kind of question, which is exploratory, it's based on genuine human curiosity. Like, you're a person, you're eternal. God created you. God created you to be here. So why don't I try and figure out what's going on, rather than, you know, coming up to someone and essentially berating them, you know, with the how could you and the finger wag and everything else like that. Now, of course, there are situations where some people are legitimately dangerous and an immediate threat to your well-being and your safety. I don't recommend going in those situations, like trying to ask a sly question. Like, if you're being held up at gunpoint, you shouldn't like try to start a therapy session to get your way out of that. God forbid. But ultimately, in the vast majority of normal human interactions, if you ask people questions and are genuinely interested in their lives, people will tell you things that you wouldn't even believe. They will relate things about themselves that you wouldn't expect, and you'll begin to find different things that are curious. And if you genuinely have that kind of attitude, then it won't take long to ask additional questions and to find yourself in a more meaningful conversation. And people want to be around people like that. Like, if we're going to unite, we can't just come in guns blazing, metaphorically speaking, to every family dinner and conversation, and just walk around scowling at everyone because we know that they hold different beliefs. If we don't know, and we're in particular, if we're making assumptions about why they do hold those beliefs, maybe someone, you know, the chain of reasoning or events that can lead to people doing or believing or saying something is so unbelievably complex that, you know, we can't even explain it ourselves. And so rather than making assumptions about who people are and what they stand for and what they care about, things that all have a tendency to change, those aren't fixed. It's better just to try to develop relationships. And that's extremely challenging, particularly when, you know, when you're in a situation where you're dealing with someone who vociferously holds opposing viewpoints. And, you know, maybe you're not going to be best friends or pal around with that person, but you have to conduct yourself in a manner that is worthy of respect. And in order to do that, you have to respect people when it is deserved. And I do my best to start from that position, unless it's clear that, you know, like abundantly clear that that can't be the place to start, in which case I avoid those situations rather than trying to be confrontational for a variety of obvious reasons. But that's my advice here. Like sometimes spiritual warfare comes in the form of asking questions and developing relationships, because these are strongholds. You're not just going to run against it with a pickaxe and start trying to hammer down these walls that people have in their lives if you don't even know why the walls are there in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if it's just to get more information about what to pray about specifically so you can target your prayers, that's always valuable also.
Yeah, you're not going to take down someone's ideology by a few quick memes you're going to post on Facebook. It's just not going to happen. You have to be able to willing to invest in that person's life and care about them. You know, one of the main roots of division is ignorance, because you don't know why they believe something, and maybe they don't know why they believe something. And then into that, you're so arrogant that you believe that you can change them quickly. It's just going to lead to more division. And that's what our political system, that ideology of quick one-liners and, you know, trying to make someone else look stupid, that's a large what our political world has become at this point. You know, Trump does it all the time, whether you support I think they're funny. Personally, I think Trump is hilarious when he goes after the media, but I often ask myself, is that really beneficial to an overarching theme? Part of me says yes, because he's exposing the lies of the media, which has been a long time coming. But a part of me says, you know, maybe it leads to more division because he's just not open. I don't know. That's a different discussion. But the importance is, you know, you have to be willing to care about someone and going past that. But even on the flip side, you have to know why you believe something. You have to do your own research and understand, you know, why are you a Christian? Have you ever asked yourself, have you ever taken the time to ask yourself, why am I a Christian? Is what I believe real? Like, is it actually real? And if you just, you know, your parents were Christians, so you became a Christian, you haven't really thought about it, that is easy picking for Satan. And at some point, someone who's not a Christian is going to ask you, so, hey, why do you believe you're a Christian? You know, I'm kind of thinking about it. And you won't have the answer for them. You know, and then that leads to them saying, ah, well, you know, if they don't have a good reason, then I'm not going to have a good reason. It's the same thing in the political world. You know, not everyone who is a Republican and not everyone who is a Democrat, whether side you're on, is a good person. You know, if you think, a great example is George Bush, George W. Bush. He's not a good person. He's part of the Skull and Bones. You can talk about 9/11 and his hands in that. He's a Republican. So if you are going to align yourself perfectly with Republicans, that's just not going to be good. You have to have your own brain. You have to have your own mind. You're not going to agree with everyone just because you have the same label. You know, it's about that independent. You have to be independent. You have to be a stone, like scripture says, you know. God uses stones because they're unique. They have their own backstory. They have their own personality. They have their own history that creates them into something that God can use uniquely and have different talents. And if you just align yourself perfectly with the narrative that's being put forth, no matter what side you're on, you're going to be a brick. You're going to be man-made, you know, perfectly square, fit into one slot that they want to fit you in, and you're just going to be building a tyranny that's going to be the downfall of of our society. So you have to be unique and you have to search the answers for yourself, and you have to be willing to understand that people are different than you and they have different reasons they believe something, so you can work together to find the one ultimate truth that is out there, which is what we find in scripture. So I definitely agree.
I would supplement that only by saying, you know, what we see from a narrative perspective is, on behalf of people who are subject to ideological capture on a variety of different spectrums, mm-hmm. it's predictable and mm-hmm. it's boring and it's not interesting and it's difficult to see how it progresses. And that's very similar and related to this idea of a brick that you espoused, you know, another brick in the wall. You as a person, your ideas, your thoughts, your worldview, that kind of structure has been formed fit without much independent and free thought going into giving real consideration to the most meaningful questions there are. And this can happen for a variety of different reasons, but it is far too prevalent in our society. And I think this, amongst many things, goes in cycles, goes in waves back and forth in terms of one generation prioritizing one thing and the other rebelling, in a sense. And, you know, we may be seeing some swinging back as opposed to just sort of the blasé approach that has been taken by the last couple generations to these sorts of questions, like the go along to get along and the pragmatist approach and the normal the sort of status quo secular humanism that is espoused by even many people who are Christians or would identify as Christians. I mean, ultimately, aren't our beliefs measured just as much by our actions, if not more, than what we say our beliefs are? Because you can say anything, but are you acting it out? You know, you can claim all of these different things verbally, but what is the actual substance? Are you practicing what you preach, so to speak? And as we continue to, you know, identify this dynamic of unity versus division, like if we're going to complain about the division, well, then what are we doing to unify? If we're going to complain about the circumstances, then what are we doing inside of our own lives to have greater unity between ourselves and Christ, ourselves and our spouses and our families? You know, is there division that we can identify that we can effectively deal with in our own lives? Everyone has it in their family. Like, you don't have to go out to the national level to recognize that there's division that you could do something about right now. And it's tough to do that because, and particularly inside of families, because division creates inertia. And it's like, well, you know, now we just had this, and I don't even remember, or I kind of do remember why it's there. And so this is just who we are now. We just live with this division. Well, the problem with that kind of approach is that over the course of 50, 60, 70, 80 years, there's guaranteed to be incidents where division comes up. And if the status quo is division sticks after one of these incidents, then every single family is going to have that kind of division in it. So I don't need to convince you of that. Look, you know, think about your own lives. If you don't have a family where there's division of some sort, then congratulations. That's a genuine blessing and something that most other people don't have the experience of dealing with. But what it does mean is that there is an opportunity for you and for me and for each and every one of us to say, hey, look, if I'm concerned about division, and I am, because we should be, because unity is preferable to division in the context of God's will, in the context of God's, the body of Christ overall, or in the context of our families, then okay, do something about it. What can you do? Well, ask a question. You know, bring something up. it's uncomfortable. It's always going to be uncomfortable to overcome inertia because you need force to move an object that is at rest. And so what if your effort fails? Oh, well, at least somebody's trying. Having that perspective around you with others, seeing that you are trying actively to do these things, communicates to them that your belief structure has you in a position where you actually care about that kind of stuff. And that's all. Sometimes that's all that's needed to give other people courage to join in as well. So we can't be afraid to go it alone and to do things that are uncomfortable or challenging for the sake of a meaningful and valuable objective. Something like unity. Now that isn't, you know, unity at any price or compromise on everything, but it's kind of a well, let's actually ask the questions and get to the bottom of the situation. And it depends on the individual circumstance, but usually it's not something as crazy as you might imagine. And, you know, if you look back on something and say, man, we've had this division as a country for a generation, for two generations, or we've had this division in our family for years and decades. At a certain point, the time spent on something like that begins to grow weary. It grows stale. The memories fade a bit. And it's in that kind of moment where unity has a greater chance of being achieved by someone who's willing to step up into the gap in their own individual circumstances. Now, if we are talking about the national political conversation in particular, this is less likely to take place when you have people who are actively pouring salt on everything and, you know, throwing gasoline on the fire and every other kind of metaphor that you want to use here. So that makes it a bit more troublesome and challenging, particularly when these people have the largest microphones and stumps to preach from in the land, in the form of mainstream media and other kind of influential people with a significant amount of reach. But at the end of all of these discussions, the answer is less about what's the cause, what's the effect at this macro level. We need to see it because we need to see these directions. We need to pay attention because we need to be informed. The question is, at the individual level, what are you going to do to make use of the freedom that God has given you and that the Constitution provides to speak your mind and to do the things that are uncomfortable or are difficult, even if it's just asking a question? And are you willing to trust God to lead you out into that unknown territory where the outcome is not certain and just be obedient to Him? You know, He's not going to say, all right, you know, take this weapon and just, you know, start slicing and dicing in spiritual warfare terms or otherwise. It's going to be, here, let me lead you through experiences that will give you the confidence and the faith in me and in what I can do through you to open the doors that are necessary to do even bigger things. And we have to start small in that area. So let's all do what we can to identify the areas in our lives where we need to make a change and areas of division that we have access to that we can do something, even if it's just speaking a soft word or asking the right question to help heal and to help bridge. Because if we, you know, if we think that we're going to change the entire nation by ourselves without moving the hand of God, if we don't have experience doing it on a small scale, then, I mean, we're out of our minds here, Sam.
Yeah, the first step of unity is going to be, you know, coming together to search for the truth. It's not going to be it's not going to be this overarching, we're all going to agree on everything. I don't think that's ever going to happen because we're also different. We have all different backgrounds. But the way we can unify is by searching together to find the truth. And that's ultimately what it's going to come down to. Can you search with your family, with your brother or sister, your mom or dad, or who you're not talking to anymore? Can you search together to find the truth? You know, can you build that bridge, you know? And then can your family work with the neighbor next door to, you know, to find some sort of truth that would help your community progress or help the your immediate area? It's never, I say this almost every show, it's never going to be a top-down change. It's always going to be a grassroots movement. It's going to be each individual battle. Every day, every choice that you make is going to, if you choose good, then more people are going to choose good, and it's going to be a theme that will slowly change our country back to what it needs to be, and even the world. Even if you're outside of America, it's going to be that's going to make the difference. It's not going to be an election. It's not going to be, a new business or a big huge idea that everyone accepts. It's going to be a grassroots movement all across the world of Christians stepping up in the battle and doing what's good. So, you know, as we finish up here, Stephen, I thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you would like us to end on?
Well, nothing other than to point out, Sam, that God is in control and that we are in a position to look to him for everything. And there are battlefields all over this land, all over this country, and that is not just at a national macro level. It's all over our lives, all over our families, and even in our own hearts. So we have to understand, like you said, that there isn't going to be a top-down solution, apart from, I suppose, the dynamic of God touching our lives and transforming hearts from the kingdom of heaven so that we can generate this this grassroots or bottom-up kind of change that we're so looking ahead to. And, you know, at the end of the day, I agree wholeheartedly with your approach that says a shared seeking of the truth is the best way to get to unity. And that's, you know, that's a challenge in and of itself, because we don't even agree on if there is a truth that we can pursue anymore. But that's a whole different story. Trusting God, continue to pray, continue to read the word, continue to seek fellowship, continue to act out your faith and ask the right questions.
Freaking postmodernists, man. They ruin everything. All right, Stephen. Hey, where can people find you? How can they support you? And do you have anything else coming up in a little bit that you want to share?
The best place to go would be our website at ontheobjective.org. Our YouTube and Twitter is On The Objective. Just search that and we'll come up on those platforms. There are some interesting conference and speaking opportunities that have yet to be finalized for 2019 for me, but things are, you know, we're going into our third year of ministry at On The Objective. We don't ask for donations. We're self-funded, and this is a labor of love for us. But I would suggest that you support all of these other fantastic ministries that are speaking the truth, that are engaging in these difficult conversations. Not because the conversations themselves are hard, but because they're rare. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to find venues where you can have such conversations. And so I'm very appreciative to you, Sam, as always, for having me on. It's worth noting that by the time this goes up, our previous interview that we recorded for On The Objective should be posted. So if you can't get enough of Sam and myself, then go over to our channel and you can find much more of where this came from.
Absolutely, guys, definitely go check them out. It is always an interesting conversation with Stephen on. Tell your wife that TSR audience says hello as she walked in. And that's our show this week, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. It's a little bit of a different take on the tons of amount of post-election analysis that you're going to receive. I hope it was different. That's what I want the Sharpen Report to be. It is different and unique. And so we dove into the spiritual ramifications of the potential good and the potential evil that may come of the outcome and how Satan and God might use it. And ultimately, again, it comes down to what you are going to do with your life. Are you going to be good? Or are you going to do evil? It's up to you. You have to choose every single day. Be a stone. Don't be a brick. Search for the truth at all costs, and everything will turn out just fine. I'm not going to ask you guys to like, subscribe, or share, but you know I appreciate it if you do. I hope you enjoy the show, and I hope that you have a great week.